Good afternoon. And again, welcome to everyone who is joining us on the internet. For those who might be joining for the first time on the internet, I will not be reading from either the first or second edition of the course, but rather from the transcript as prepared by Bill Thetford. So when you find differences between what I'm reading and what you're reading in the first and second editions, you will understand why. Okay, and the section is entitled Love Without Conflict. You have never understood what the kingdom of heaven is within you means. The reason you have not understood it is because it is not understandable to the ego, which interprets it as if something outside is inside, and this does not mean anything. The word within is unnecessary. The kingdom of heaven is you. And I'm going to repeat that. The kingdom of heaven is you. What else but you did the Creator create? And what else but you is His kingdom? This is the whole message of the Atonement, a message which, in its totality, transcends the sum of its parts. Christmas is not a time, it is a state of mind. And I'm going to add, just as being is. Continuing, the Christ mind wills from the soul, not from the ego. And the Christ mind is yours. This pretty well summarizes what we talked about last week and what we've been talking about for some weeks now. And that is that the mind that you are using to give definitions to everything is the Christ mind. And the mind that you are using to believe the definitions you are giving to everything, instead of the full capital M meaning that God is expressing in everything, is the Christ mind. It's the only mind there is. And you either allow it to be the absolute fullness and totality of you, or you imaginatively use it as though it's a tool with which you can be creative like the Father while ignoring the Father completely. This is why the kingdom of heaven is you. Returning home is you coming back into your right mind. It's not a place. It's you returning to sanity. Continuing. You, too, have a kingdom which your soul created. It, meaning your soul, has not ceased to create because your ego has set you on the road of perception or definitions. Your soul's creations are no more fatherless than you are. Your ego and your soul will never be co-creators, but your soul and your creator will always be. Be confident that your creations are as safe as you are. And I'm going to remind you again that the way in which you, fully awakened, are co-creators with God lies in the fact that when you are not presenting any suggestion of independent authorship, you, in so many words, sit on God's shoulder while God bees the movement of creation. And you are the observing of the movement of creation. In other words, you are allowing your mind to have nothing present in it but the mind of God that is the movement of creation, and your function is to be the conscious awareness of that movement of creation in its totality with God simultaneously. In this way, the movement of creation becomes yours. Not as a separate creator, but as nothing less and nothing more than the conscious, the full conscious experience of all of the meaning of the movement of creation. You become co-creators by virtue of not introducing anything extraneous any longer to the movement of creation that God is being. When it says, be confident that your creations are as safe as you are, it means that what has truly been being, what has truly been created, all the time you have been dallying with the ego, and you apparently have missed it because of your preoccupation with what you have made up, all of that will become available to you once again, as eternal and as ever available to you as your conscious experience. All of reality that has been occurring while you have been dallying with the ego will become your conscious experience once again. Continuing. The kingdom is perfectly united and perfectly protected, and the ego will not prevail against it. Amen. That was written in that form because it is a good thing to use as a kind of a prayer in moments of temptation. Moments of temptation. Like what? I've got a headache, or the suggestion is whispered in your ear by the ego that says, your financial picture is pretty tight, and you have some demands coming up, and you're not going to be able to meet them, and therefore it's appropriate for you to indulge in fear. Those are moments of temptation to become further distracted and further preoccupied with a consciousness of existence that has nothing to do with God and with your birthright of wholeness, When that happens, it is helpful to remind yourself, quote, the kingdom is perfectly united and perfectly protected. In other words, it isn't being altered by my momentary perception of lack and the fear that it's generating. My wholeness is still whole and untouched, and the ego will not prevail against it. Now, the ego is not going to not prevail against it because you're making this declaration. The ego is not going to prevail against it because reality is unalterable and the ego is purely imaginary and therefore has no capacity to accomplish a thing. Continuing regarding the prayer, it is a declaration of independence. Dangerous words, declaration of independence, because your ego state of mind is itself a declaration of independence from God. So this has to be referring to your birthright of independence from being the puppet of an imaginary presence that you call the ego. Making this declaration of independence, recognizing that you need not play into being governed by the suggestion that fear is justified, is not enough. The Declaration of Independence says, in so many words, there is another way to look at this. But that acknowledgement is not all that's necessary. It is then necessary to say, to turn to the Father, to turn to the altar within and say, what is the truth here? What is another way to look at this that embodies the Father's will so that I may know that I am safe and whole and that the ego's suggestion of fear is totally unjustified. So the declaration of independence from the ego is the first step in turning toward the answer that completely nullifies whatever the suggestion is that the ego has put before you and enticed you with. Continuing. In its characteristically upside-down way, the ego has taken the impulses from the superconscious and perceives them as if they arise in the unconscious. What are the impulses from the superconscious? Simply, the insight, the inspiration that comes from the Father to you when you have turned toward the altar. So, in its characteristically upside-down way, the ego has taken the impulses from the superconscious and perceives them as if they arise in the unconscious. The ego judges what is to be accepted, and the impulses from the superconscious are unacceptable to it because they clearly point to the non-existence of the ego itself. The ego, therefore, experiences threat, and not only censors, but also reinterprets the data. However, as Freud correctly pointed out, what you have repressed can retain a very active life beyond your awareness. This is a very important point, because it's something you can depend on. If you repress the allness of God and His fatherhood, then, and if you repress that, you may know that it has a life of its own that goes on beyond your willingness to recognize it. And it goes on your behalf, constantly. That's good news. Continuing. Repression thus operates to conceal not only the baser impulses, but also the most lofty ones from awareness, because both are threatening to the ego, and being concerned primarily with its own preservation in the face of threat, the ego perceives them as the same. The threat value of the lofty is actually much greater to the ego, because the pull of God Himself can hardly be equated with the pull of human appetites. By perceiving them as the same, the ego attempts to save itself from being swept away, as it would surely be in the presence of knowledge, or capital K knowing. The upper level of the unconscious thus contains the call of God as well as the call of the body. That is why the basic conflict between love and fear is unconscious. The ego cannot tolerate either and represses both by resorting to inhibition. Society depends on inhibiting the latter, meaning fear. But salvation depends on disinhibiting the former, meaning love. The reason you need my help is because you have repressed your own guide and therefore need guidance. My role is to separate the true from the false in your unconscious so it can break through the barriers the ego has set up and shine into your minds. Against our united strength, the ego cannot prevail. Again, this is so very important. And it's the reason that I'm reading from the transcript. Because in the transcript, it makes it clear that my communion with Helen and Bill was the point, not the message. The message is important, but it is our joining, it is our communion, it is our mutual working together that promotes the actual shift in consciousness that each of you needs to undergo. And I am constantly reminding you in these gatherings that I am available to each one of you directly, just as your guides are, and that we are there for the purpose of joining, for the purpose of communion, because it's in that ending of isolation that the shift back into your sanity is facilitated. It is the means of coming home. Continuing. It should be apparent to you by now why the ego regards the soul as its enemy. The ego arose from the separation, and its continued existence depends on your continuing belief in the separation. You see? Having reduced the soul impulses to the unconscious, the ego has to offer you some sort of reward for maintaining this belief, this mindset, this definition. All it can offer is a sense of temporary existence, which begins with its own beginning and ends with its own ending. It tells you this life is your existence because it is its own. And remember last week we were talking about the three questions you have: who am I, what am I, and why am I here? You have those questions because the ego's existence is temporary. It's not real, but it's claiming to be. And because it itself is a denial of God, it is a denial of that which gives real identity to you. And so your sense of yourself is temporary. Identity-less, without any conscious experience of what your true, real, meaningful function is. Continuing, against this sense of temporary existence, the soul offers you the knowledge, the knowing, of permanence and unshakable being. No one who has experience the revelation of this can ever fully believe in the ego again. How can its meager offering to you prevail against the glorious gift of God? I'm adding the word naturally here. Naturally, you who identify with your egos cannot believe that God loves you. You, identifying with your egos, do not love what you have made, and what you made does not love you. Being made out of the denial of the Father, the ego has no allegiance to its maker. And again, to be clear here, being made out of the denial of the Father, the Christ that you are is unconscious of the Father and therefore has no means of giving allegiance to its own maker, God. You must remember that the ego isn't a thing in itself. It's a Christ choosing to give new definitions to everything, believing the definitions, and in the process losing the full conscious awareness of its Christhood because it's preferring the definition of itself that it has created for itself. And in that state of affairs, the Christ that you are has no allegiance to its own maker, which is God. Again, it doesn't make any of this true. But this is the understanding of the dynamic that makes things seem the way they seem to be. Continuing, you cannot conceive of the real relationship which exists between God and his souls because of the hatred you have for the self you have made. You project onto your own idea of yourself the will to separate, which conflicts with the love you feel for what you made because you made it. No human love is without this ambivalence. In other words, no love that you have for anything you made separate from God is without this ambivalence. And since no ego has experienced love without ambivalence, the concept is beyond its understanding. Because it's beyond its understanding, resolution of the problem of being cannot occur from within the ego's perceptions, the ego's, quote, understanding, unquote. And that is why awakening requires your reaching beyond your best definitions, your best thoughts, your best principles. To know what the truth is that you didn't create. Continuing, love will enter immediately into any mind which truly wants it, but it must want it truly. This means that it wants it without ambivalence. And this kind of wanting is wholly without the ego's drive to get. There is a kind of experience which is so different from anything the ego can offer that you will never recover. The word recover is used quite literally here. You will never be able to cover or hide again. It is necessary to repeat here that your belief in darkness and in hiding is why the light cannot enter. Remember that your beliefs are powerful for you because they are definitions you have created which you have invested confidence, trust, and commitment in. And where you give your commitment is what you will have. And until you will for something different, it will not change. At the bottom line, beliefs are houses built upon sand. Houses built out of straw. Beliefs are insubstantial and structurally unsound. Beliefs are imaginary. But when you create the belief and you make commitment to it, the laws that you apply to it are the laws by which you will govern your conscious awareness of things, and you will disallow for the full conscious experience of what is real. And so for you, you will be in a limited experience, even though the fullness of the kingdom of heaven is going on without interruption and without alteration. Again, love will enter immediately into any mind which truly wants it, but it must want it truly. And the experience of it is so different from anything the ego can offer that you will never recover, never be able to cover or hide again. Continuing, the Bible gives many references to the immeasurable gifts which are for you, but for which you must ask. And the only reason you must ask for them is because you have denied them, you have blocked them out of your experience, you have said, I don't want them, I want only what I have made up for myself. You, in so many words, set them outside the door of your tiny limit of conscious awareness. And because you set them out there, you must invite them back in. You must undo your denial. You must undo your objection to reality. Continuing, this is not a condition as the ego sets conditions. It is the glorious condition of what you are. This is very important. No force except your own will is strong enough or worthy enough to guide you. In this you are as free as God and must remain so forever. You can never be bound except in honor, and that is always voluntary. Let us ask the Father in my name to keep you mindful of his love for you and yours for him. You can reach out to the Father for his love by yourself, but I invite you to do it with me consciously, so that you might have my support when your commitment is weak, when your willingness falters. Continuing, he has never failed to answer this request because it asks only for what he has already willed. Those who call truly are always answered. Thou shalt have no other gods before him, because there are none. And it's time for you to stop making gods out of your own definitions, out of the understandings that you have come to through your human reasoning, based upon your being a mortal. Continuing, it has never really entered your mind to give up every idea you ever had that opposes knowledge, or capital K, knowing. One of the reasons it's never really entered your mind to give up every idea you ever had that opposes knowing is because you didn't know there was such a thing as knowing. You didn't know that the mind of God is your mind to be experienced from God's perspective. You thought that you had a mind like God, which God gave you as a separate, as a creation separate from him, and that you were to honor and use this mind on your own. So it was natural not to ever have the idea enter your mind to give up all of your thoughts. You retain thousands of little scraps of meanness which prevent the Holy One from entering. And without going into gross levels of meanness, let's just say that an idea that you have to look at a thing and determine what it is by yourself, without the Father, that's a mean idea. It's not an embracing idea. It's a very private, separate, selfish idea. light, continuing, light cannot penetrate through the walls you make to block it. And it is forever unwilling to destroy what you have made. No one can see through a wall, but I can step around it. Watch your minds for the scraps of meanness, or you will be unable to ask me to do so. I can help you only as our Father created us. I will love you and honor you and maintain complete respect for what you have made. But I will neither honor it nor love it unless it is true. And you know what? That makes me your best friend. Because you can't pull shit on me. And when you do so out of habit and not out of conscious meanness, I will not join you in agreement about it. And I will clarify the discrepancy without calling your integrity into question. I will do it by holding before you a clear sense of the fact that you not only have integrity, you are integrity embodied because you're God expressed. And I will confirm that to you in ways that will help you to see that your devotion to a contrary belief is useless and meaningless, but not self-demeaning of you. Because by virtue of confronting you with your unchangeable integrity, it's obvious to you that you thereby have an integrity with which to disagree with an ignorance or a flaw in your thinking. You are strong enough, you are credible enough, you are real enough to be able to deny a definition you gave to yourself or to your world without threatening or undermining your existence. And that is very important. Continuing, I will never forsake you, any more than God will, but I must wait as long as you choose to forsake yourself. Now, not only must I wait, I will gladly wait. I will gladly forever stand ready to help you the moment you decide, for whatever reason, that it's no longer worth it to you to try to create the world and universe out of whole cloth, out of pure imagination, and that it's not worth it to you to continue longer experiencing the frustration of no real fulfillment felt. So I must wait, and I will wait. Continuing, because I wait in love and not in impatience, you will surely ask me truly. I will come in response to a single, unequivocal call. Watch carefully and see what it is you are really asking for. Be very honest with yourself about this. For we must hide nothing from each other. If you will really try to do this, you have taken the first step to preparing your mind for the Holy One. to enter. We will prepare for this together. For once he has come, you will be ready to help me make other minds ready for him. How long will you deny him his kingdom? Put another way, how long will you deny yourself the experience of the fact that you are the kingdom? Continuing, in your own unconscious, we could say, in your own unconsciousness of God, deeply repressed by the ego, is the declaration of your release. God has given you everything. This is the one fact that means the ego does not exist, and which therefore makes it profoundly afraid. In the ego's language, remember, to have and to be are different, but they are identical to the soul. The soul knows that you both have everything and are everything. Any distinction in this respect is meaningful only when the idea of getting, which implies a lack, has already been accepted. In other words, when that thought becomes a definition of reality to you, and you embrace it and make commitment to it, it becomes for you a fact. Continuing, that is why we made no distinction before between having the kingdom of God and being the kingdom of God. The calm being of God's kingdom, which in your sane mind is perfectly conscious, is ruthlessly banished from the part of the mind which the ego rules. The ego is desperate because it opposes literally invincible odds, whether you are asleep or awake. Consider how much vigilance you have been willing to exert to protect your ego, and how little you have been willing to expend to protect your higher mind. Who but the insane would undertake to believe what is not true, and then protect this belief at the cost of truth? Well, who would? And the practical and helpful answer is, you wouldn't if you knew better. You see how that answer leaves your self-respect and integrity intact? If I said the answer was, well, only an idiot would do that, well, now we'd have to spend some time undoing all of the feelings you have about being an idiot. If you knew better, you wouldn't do it. And so the solution to that problem is for someone to tell you how to do it better. And you know what? That's what you get from your guide. That's what you get from the Holy Spirit. It doesn't convict you of anything. It shows you that you are more than what you thought you were. You are more than the definition you have been applying to yourself. And it helps you feel from that greater definition or greater truth about you the strength, the impulse to abandon your definition, so that you might not unknowingly be bound by an ignorance and might be freed by knowing the truth. Because you deserve to know the truth, because you are God's expression. You are something more than the puny, measly definition of yourself that you have been applying to yourself. It's very simple, really. When you have made up a definition of yourself, and you are no longer consciously embodying the divine meaning that the Father has expressed and that appears as you, then, as we've said before, you feel separate, alone, vulnerable, fearful. And everything that comes after that is a conscious means of defending yourself in this irrevocable state of vulnerability that you find yourself experiencing. And therefore, love is never really love when you express it. It's always serving you as a defense. As a result, love is conflicted. Love that is used as a defense is a conflicted expression of something which in itself, if it weren't being used for defense, would uncover to you the fact that there isn't one single element of anything that is at odds with you, and therefore there is no need for self-defense of any sort. And so this section that we've been reading makes this clear so that you might make a choice for real love, the real capacity, first of all, to feel God's love for you because you have decided to become defenseless against God and let God in by invitation on your part. And then, in the infilling of love that you are filled by, extending it without conflict to your brother and to your world and to your universe, so that its extension is not an act of defense in any way. Now, doing this is the first step the pushing and the causing to fall of the first domino. Because when you love from this place of unconflicted love, it is felt by others. And whether they can put their finger on it or not, something has changed in their life. And they can't ever be quite as covered up again. And so you become an agent for change, if you will. Change of what? Change of the minds, the hearts, you might say, of your brothers and sisters. The need is to get back to unconflicted love. It's your birthright. And you know what else? It is your joy to experience. Because in the experience of it, you discover again that this is your function. This is your purpose. It is not why you are here, it is why you exist, period. And if it is your function, that is who you are. Who you are is love. What you are is love. This is why you keep hearing the simplicity, love one another. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you would like them to come from the place of excellence in themselves, that which reflects God in them, then you come from the place of excellence in you. That place where God is in you. Love one another. As I have loved you, love one another. Love is the answer. It's an age-old song. Shall I say an age-old melody, an age-old theme? But unfortunately, it's been taken as an idea for little independent egos to embody and actualize from their little tiny egohood. And so you get zealots. You get little egos running around being loving, extending love to their neighbor, which literally is meant cramming it down their throat. It's been a matter of figuring out what love is. Well, love, it must be good behavior. It must be kindness. It must be thoughtfulness. And so you put together a package of behaviors that you all mutually agree are the definition of love. But again, nobody's thought to ask God, what is love? Nobody has thought to turn to God and say, you know what? The only thing I can do is to make up a bunch of ideas about what love is and create a package of definitions and a criteria of behaviors that then I can implement. But you know what? I don't get a feeling from that. I only get a result of, let's say, improved harmony with everyone, but I don't get a feeling with it. I don't get a feeling of connection with my brother. There's just a sort of a physical harmony. And so, God, because my definitions of love and my implementation of my definitions of love, because they aren't fulfilling, I'm willing to set them aside, Father, and ask you to provide me with the experience of being loved by you. I would like to have the experience of not being separate and apart, where I have to make up my own definitions and then convince everyone else about them, of them, and try and make them work in the world I see. Help me. Fill me up with the experience of being loved. And I, with all of my ability, will attempt to be defenseless enough to not block your entry into my conscious awareness. I invite you in, and I realize that it's my responsibility to let you in, because you never ever withdrew from me. I will even ask you to help me be more defenseless, more yielding.
Are we talking defenselessness and yielding just to God?
Someone here asked, are we talking about defenselessness only to God? And the answer to that is yes, because until you become defenseless against God, which is the source of your being, and therefore that which gives you the experience of identity, you will still see yourself as separate from your brothers and sisters. And any expression of love that you make from that state of separateness is always going to involve, as I said earlier, certain elements of self-defense, which means that it's not really love. The only way any of you will find yourself able to extend unconflicted love is to become defenseless against the Father first. Because it's the infilling of the love that God is that will uncover to you your divine function as the son or daughter of God. And that is, it is in that experience of infilling that you have the love of God, you might say, to pass on to your brother and sister. And that love will be unconflicted and will embody no elements of defense, will be unconflicted in any way. That is what has been bandied about as unconditional love. Again, though, unconditional love has been a concept which little egos have been trying to implement and embody, again, without ever joining with the Father, where the living love of God is available, and which, when you allow it into yourself and through you, becomes unconditional love expressed to your brother and sister. You see. Now, the next section, which we will not go into today, is entitled The Escape from Fear. And I think that you can begin to see that the escape from fear is the result of inviting in and letting flow through you unconflicted love. While I have been speaking, I have been being with all of you sort of like a roto-rooter. Facilitating deep changes. Deep shifts within you. An expression of my love. And so, without any further embellishment, we will end for today, except that I will let you know that next Sunday, after I have spoken as I've spoken today, since there's been no opportunity for the last month or so for anyone to ask questions or make comments or objections, we will take a period of time after the discussion of the course for you to bring up questions relative to what we've been discussing and pursue them more deeply, let us say. And so I will say I love you, and I look forward to being with you all next week. You are welcome.